From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. 7 million Americans take insulin every day to survive. The drug was first developed almost a century ago, but for the past couple of decades, the price of insulin has gone through the roof. It's become so expensive, almost a quarter of people who take insulin have had to ration it. And some of them are dying. How did it get this way? How did such a vital, well-known, long-developed drug get so far out of reach for so many Americans? Especially when that exact same drug can cost a tenth of the price in other countries. Pharma execs were hauled before a congressional committee last week to give their view. Drug maker Eli Lilly says it will cut the price for a version of its insulin in half. But there is a deeper problem here, one that will take myriad solutions. So this hour on Point, insulin and fixing America's broken prescription drug pricing system. And you can join us. Are you reliant on insulin to survive? Had you had to ration it? How are you coping with prices that have tripled in a decade? And with drug manufacturers, pharmacy benefit managers, and insurers all pointing the finger at each other, what can be done? Is an entire overhaul of the U.S. system needed? And I should say right off the bat here, we invited the three major drug makers who make insulin, Sanofi, Eli Lilly, and Novo Nordisk, to join us on the program today. They all declined. They sent us statements instead, and you'll be hearing from those statements throughout the hour. We also invited the major lobbying group, Pharma, to join us as well. They declined, too. So instead, let's start by listening for a few minutes to some activists who are confronting the insulin problem in a very public way.
Sanofi, you can't hide. Your drug prices are homicide. Sanofi.
Well, this was just yesterday outside the Cambridge, Massachusetts offices of Sanofi, one of the three drug makers that control 99% of the insulin market. A small group of about 10 protesters were standing in front of a makeshift set of tombstones. These tombstones were tall, painted in black, with white letters of names of people who've died because they couldn't get insulin. One of those names is Megan Carter. Stephanie Ains is with the Right Care Alliance. They're a medical activist group. And she told us Carter's story.
Megan had just gotten a new insurance. And she was in between jobs, got her new job, got her new insurance, and was days away from the insurance kicking in when she died.
Well, the average price of insulin has nearly tripled in a 10-year period. Patients with insurance might have to pay as much as $300 for a single vial of insulin that could last them just a week or two. Now, Sanofi says it has programs to help patients reduce out-of-pocket expenses, but protester Michael Noble says that's not enough. He's wearing a shirt emblazoned with the words, "Am I next?" And he says he saw how precious insulin was back when he was a teenager at a camp for diabetic kids.
A lot of my counselors were dependent upon those camps to get the donated insulin that was supplied to them. And so that was their health insurance, was going to these camps, working there over the summer, just desperately hoarding as much insulin and medical supplies as they could until the next camp session.
Well, the protesters eventually tried to enter the Sanofi building. They asked to meet with a major executive, but security guards threatened to call the police.
No, you cannot.
You know that's not allowed.
You're not allowed.
So the protesters leave, and back outside, 70-year-old Martin Drilling, who's had type 1 diabetes for more than 60 years, he says the solution won't come from just pharma companies, and he has a message for Congress.
So I would just emphasize the point that in the richest country in the world, we should not be discarding our humans and citizens so companies can make more money. It is incomprehensible to me that they have not come up with a plan to address this pressing need.
Well, joining us now in the studio is Dr. Vikas Sani. He helped lead the demonstration at Sanofi's Cambridge, Massachusetts offices yesterday. He's a cardiologist and co-chair of the Right Care Alliance, that is a patient advocacy coalition. He's also president of the Loan Institute. It's a nonpartisan healthcare think tank that's challenging the high cost of healthcare in America. Dr. Sani, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, also with us today is Dr. Kasia Lipska. She's joining us from New Haven, Connecticut. She's an endocrinologist and a diabetes researcher at the Yale School of Medicine. She's published studies on patients having to ration insulin due to the cost. Dr. Lipska, welcome to you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Sani, let me start with you. You're leading protests in front of buildings that are owned by research centers that are owned by companies like Sanofi. Why are you targeting the drug companies specifically?
We're targeting the drug companies because they are ground zero of the ecosystem. It's not that others are not without blame, but it's absolutely clear that the drug companies have been playing a central role in both the pricing and in the backroom deals that they engage in with other players in the system. And all of that has been designed to maximize revenue and maximize profits. It's very clear. You know, you said the price of insulin has gone up 3 times in 10 years. It's gone up 10 times in the lifetime of some of these young people who've died. So, and there's been no new development or innovation of those agents, those drugs in that period of time.
Backroom deals?
Absolutely.
Meaning what?
What I mean is that our pricing system is really broken. It is seriously broken. First of all, backroom deals means that the published price or the list price, you know, which is typically the average wholesale price, is relatively arbitrarily set. Now, by statute, there's another price that they're controlled by. But after that, in the back room, insurance companies, pharmaceutical benefits managers, and drug companies cut deals. And in those deals, money is flowing in all directions. And while they point the finger at each other, I think it's pretty clear that they're all profiting, and the people who are losing are these patients.
Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about sort of how it seems as if these three companies have moved their prices in lockstep with each other as well. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But Dr. Lipska, if I can just turn to you, I mean, you're an endocrinologist, and you have even published a study, one in the Journal of the American Medical Association, where you found that at Yale, 1 in 4 diabetes patients had reported rationing their insulin due to cost.
That's right, Meghna. And this really came on my radar several years ago when I had a patient come in to see me. He's 70 years old. He's an engineer. He's got a good job, but he's supporting his wife and his divorced daughter. So money is somewhat tight. And he actually brought me the bills for his insulin to the appointment. He's been on insulin for a while. He's type 2 diabetes. But in order to control his blood sugar, she really needed this insulin. And the bills were enormous. They were, you know, in the range of $400 to $500 a month that he was spending out of pocket on his insulin, and he just couldn't afford it. And after seeing him, I started asking lots of my patients about trouble affording insulin and started hearing more and more stories, one after another. Mm. And that led me to think, well, is this doesn't seem to be an anomaly. We better look into this. And that's exactly when we decided with 2 students to do a survey in our Yale Diabetes Center to ask patients who were prescribed insulin, okay, over the last 12 months, how many of you have had to not fill a prescription, use less than prescribed, ration insulin because of its cost? And we found that it was, as you said, 1 in 4 patients reporting this, doing this.
What effect is it having on their lives?
Well, insulin is, as you heard, it's essential for anyone with type 1 diabetes. So not taking insulin is fatal. People die without insulin. For in terms of rationing insulin, if you have type 2 or type 1 diabetes and you take less than prescribed and your blood sugars go up, then you're at high risk for these devastating consequences of diabetes, like blindness, kidney failure, going on dialysis, ulcers in your feet, having amputations, and heart disease. So these are really serious consequences when blood sugars go up.
Mm. Well, Dr. Sani, let me turn back to you on this, because I think the thing that is so disturbing about the challenges around this particular drug is because, A, diabetes is such a widespread disease in America. I mean, there's, of course, type 1 diabetes, but also type 2. We have tens of millions of Americans who may be pre-diabetic as well. So here's a drug that potentially is critical to saving millions and millions of people's lives. It's also been forms of insulin have been on the market for almost a century. It's not a new drug. You know, it's not one of those new gene-based therapies that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. But the three major companies, Novo Nordisk, Eli Lilly, and Sanofi, in all of their statements, they say, it's not us. It's those pharmacy benefit managers. It's those insurers. It's the other parts of America's broken pricing system here. Do they not have a point?
No. The reality is, as I said earlier, it is them. It's not just them, but it is them. To put it a different way, you know, when insulin first came out, the kind that was purified by Banting and Best, for which they got the Nobel Prize and sold their patent for $1, we calculated that the price of a month of insulin in those days, that's innovation. In those days, it was $20 a month. Now, if you fast forward, there has been innovation since then, and there are newer insulins. But again, there's been no innovation on those insulins for 20 years.
So these are the synthetics.
The synthetics, absolutely. Okay. Now, what happens is the pharmacy benefit managers have an interest in escalating the prices, and the pharma companies go along. And the reason is the pharma companies really don't feel the pinch. They keep getting their amount. What ends up happening is the insurance companies get a discount. They get to look good. And the pharmacy benefits managers pocket a huge part of the discount. So we've created a system in which everybody has an interest in rising prices.
Except patients. Well, Dr. Vikas Saini and Dr. Kasia Lipska, stand by here for just a second. We are talking about the story of why such a critically important drug in America, insulin, has become so expensive it's out of reach, potentially for almost a quarter of the Americans who rely on it to live. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about insulin and how and why it's become so expensive in the United States that 25% of the 7 million Americans who rely on insulin to live have rationed the drug that they need to stay alive. I'm joined today by Dr. Vikas Saini and Dr. Kasia Lipska. And we did invite the three major drug makers who control 99% of the insulin market, Eli Lilly, Sanofi, and Novo Nordisk. They all declined but sent us statements. And their statements actually have some commonalities in them. Let me just read a couple sentences here. For example, this is from Eli Lilly. They say, we want to provide help for people who need it while not disrupting access for the thousands of Humalog patients. That's the name, the brand name of their insulin, who pay lower prices because of their insurance. The significant rebates we pay on insulins do not directly benefit all patients, and this needs to change. Novo Nordisk says as well, one of the reasons for the disparity between list price and net price is the demand by payers, those are those insurers and those pharmacy benefit managers, for higher rebates. These increasing demands for rebates from payers allow Novo Nordisk to maintain and expand the availability of its medicines. However, Novo Nordisk has no ability to control whether the rebates it pays enable broader access to the medicines and lower out-of-pocket costs. So the other major drug maker, Sanofi, their CEO was testified before Congress last week with other pharma CEOs. And so let's listen to what Oliver Brandicore, CEO of Sanofi, said. He pointed a finger at the insurance reimbursement system, saying something very similar. But here's what he told Congress.
If you take Lantus, for instance, our most prescribed insulin, the net price has fallen by 30% since 2012. Yet, over the same period, average out-of-pocket costs have risen approximately 60% for patients with commercial insurance and Medicare. It is my belief that declining net prices should result in lower out-of-pocket costs for patients. But clearly, this is not always the case.
That's Sanofi CEO Oliver Brandicore. In that very same hearing, though, Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon just wasn't having it, this idea that it's middlemen that are causing the problems. He criticized Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla for blaming high out-of-pocket costs on insurance companies.
The number one reason consumers are getting hammered is because these list prices, which you have the last word with respect to where they are unaffordable. And all this other stuff you talk about, the rebates and the discounts and the coupons, is window dressing. And the fact is 40% of the drugs don't even have a rebate. So I want it understood, you and others in the industry are stonewalling on the key issue, which is actually lowering list prices.
It's Democratic Senator from Oregon, Ron Wyden. Well, I want to bring into the conversation now Dylan Scott. He's a healthcare reporter at Vox, and he covers prescription drug pricing. We have links to his reporting at onpointradio.org. Dylan, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So let's focus a little bit on what the pharma companies are saying here. I mean, specifically about insulin. They're pointing at insurers and those pharmacy benefit managers as the problem. I did ask this question to Dr. Sani before, but do they have a point?
I would concur with the doctor's diagnosis here that I do think, you know, pharmaceutical companies aren't wrong that health insurers and pharmacy benefit managers play a role in the high costs that patients ultimately feel. But he's also right that the pharmaceutical companies set the starting point here when they set these list prices. It's from those list prices that these rebates and discounts that they like to cite as the reason that patients aren't feeling all the savings. They're the ones who are setting the starting point for those negotiations, and the discounts are negotiated from there. And so I think that's why you see these lawmakers continually come back to this point that while, yes, there may be issues with the way that we pay for prescription drugs and the savings that are realized there aren't being seen by patients, but the list prices really are the jumping off point for all of these discussions, and we've seen them steadily rise over the years.
Okay, so let me ask about how they've been rising, and I want to get the view from all three of you here, because from the charts that I've seen, those list prices have been rising in lockstep, right? The three companies are raising them almost at exactly the same time, so the exact same dollar amount. Now, there's no strict monopoly here, but three companies acting together, broadly speaking, looks like collusion on prices. Dylan, is that what's happening?
Well, I don't know that we can say for sure, but the data certainly is suggestive. The Washington Post put out an analysis a couple years ago that showed that Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk had raised their prices on insulin by 450% above inflation and very closely in sync. So there does seem to be a pretty demonstrable pattern of these prices rising together across the three companies.
Dr. Lipska, what do you think about that?
Well, I agree. And I think what we can take away from this is that there doesn't seem to be a healthy competition going on. So when you look at those prices in lockstep, those prices are for products that are very similar, Humalog versus Novolog, which are the rapid-acting insulins, Lantus, Levemir, which are the long-acting insulins, and they've really been going up at the same time by about the same amount. So no healthy competition between these products that would really cause the prices to come down.
But Dr. Sani, let me ask you, are there any generics for insulin? And if not, what's keeping the generics out of the market? Because due to my basic understanding of how these things work, that would be a force to help bring down prices, wouldn't it?
It would, but the same is true in the general generic market. We have a sort of frenzy of price gouging across the board, including in generics. I think the overall sort of tone and tenor in the market has become profit-seeking. The fact is generics could, but in the case of insulin, when you have essentially a cartel that controls such a large market with huge margins, it's very easy for them to buy out competitors, to stonewall, to evergreen patents, to do all the things that pharmaceutical sector does to maintain their monopoly grip. And I think that's what's been going on. Could it be done? Could somebody organize a company and try to disrupt the market? Yes. But over what time frame and with what odds of success?
But so these things that you said that the pharma companies do, where they, in your words, evergreen patents, or they slightly modify drugs or the delivery systems to extend patent protection on them, things like that, totally legal. And then the idea behind this is to protect the space for innovation. So what's the problem there? Well, you're shaking your head like you're disgusted that I even asked the question.
Well, the issue of innovation really is something that irritates me to no end. When we really stop and think about it, what drives innovation? When somebody has a creative idea, what drives that? Is it because they're sitting there thinking, how can I make a buck? Not really. Real innovation comes from a very different place. When you look at the numbers, most innovation and most of the funding for R&D that leads to top-selling drugs is funded by the taxpayer.
Through the NIH.
Through the NIH. Where is our return on investment? I don't see it. It's not, you know, the fact is we've created these rules. Yes, it's not illegal what's going on. That's because we've made it legal. This is something that can be changed and needs to change, but it won't really change until people start demanding it.
Dylan Scott, let me turn back to you because just the stories about the lengths that people have had to go to get insulin that they can afford are truly heartbreaking. I mean, we've, you know, in the past couple of days, we've been reading and talking to people who say they will fly to Taiwan, for example, because the plane ticket to Taiwan, and while costly, the net cost of given how much they save when they buy their insulin in other countries makes a plane ticket cheaper and worth it. Why is it that something like insulin can be one-tenth the price internationally than it is here in the United States?
Well, a big part of it is that international healthcare systems tend to have a lot more bargaining power with pharmaceutical companies. Even if they don't necessarily have a single-payer healthcare system, their healthcare or their health insurance tends to be more nationalized. The government tends to be more aggressive about regulating prices, and so that allows those other countries to negotiate lower prices for insulin than we're able to see. Here in the United States, we have set up a system where companies get a decade or more of a market monopoly whenever they develop a new drug. And as the doctor alluded to, whenever they, you know, update their drug or find a new way to deliver it or, you know, make it longer lasting, they're able to renew that monopoly and keep extending it. And that's particularly what we've seen here with insulin. While there were certainly, you know, 30 years ago, some very important innovations in making, you know, making sure that patients had fewer bad reactions, that kind of thing, the innovations we've seen more recently, I think a little, their efficacy is a little bit more questionable. And one of the most interesting conversations I've had lately with people who follow drug prices is whether we have too much innovation, whether we're being too liberal in allowing drug companies to claim that they've created a new product and keep their monopoly when really they're just making tweaks on the edges that don't change the fundamental nature of the medicine.
Dr. Lipska, what do you think about that?
I couldn't agree more. It's worth pointing out that, you know, as we've improved, as it's true, insulin now is much better than it was many decades ago. But how much better and at what cost, right? That's the fundamental question. So some of my research had looked at the older versions of human insulin called NPH and regular insulin versus the newer insulin analogs and compared them with respect to how effective they are, how safe they are in patients mostly in type 2 diabetes. And really what we've seen is very, very small advantages for people with type 2 diabetes for these older insulin products versus the newer drugs, with the newer drugs being so much more expensive. So the question is, are they really worth the cost? And again, like what is the value of this innovation? Now, for people with type 1 diabetes, I think that the advantages are more clear. Yet, you know, a lot of people with type 2 diabetes can do just as well with these older insulins.
Well, I'm going to get to callers here in just a second. But Dr. Sani, let me turn a comment to you here that we've got from a listener on Facebook. Paul Norton says, that the free market is the solution, but with better regulation. The free market is why we have innovations. Look at small companies innovating cures and new drug choices here. I mean, Paul getting to a point that the pharma companies themselves will say is that there have to be some drugs whose prices and profits help subsidize their future research.
Well, when you look at the facts, what you see is that the R&D budgets of the pharma sector, about 18 to 20% is spent on novel drugs. The other 80% is spent on tweaking, on doing other kinds of things like evergreening and the like. A lot of the times, it's taxpayer-funded research that they then translate. So I don't dispute that you need innovation. What I dispute is the fact that the market incentives, the so-called market incentives, because it isn't a functioning market, I completely agree. But what I dispute is that the source of innovation is this incentive to make a bundle of bucks. I mean, the reality of people that I know who are innovators, who are entrepreneurs, it's the joy of making something different and changing the world. And the money is secondary. And I think that's how we should organize the entire healthcare sector. It can't be based on a commodity idea that that's how healthcare works. It's a public good. And that's really why we're doing what we're doing in the Right Care Alliance, because we think it has to go in that direction.
Well, let's go to our callers. Let's go to Stephanie, who's calling from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Stephanie, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm in my mid-30s. I've been type 1 diabetic since I was 4. When I graduated college, I started living abroad because I could not afford, at that point as a 22-year-old, the medications that I needed that had been around for years. I bought insulin, Humalog insulin, in South Korea for $55. I bought it in Dubai for $72. I came back to the United States when Obamacare came, and I was able to live here again and have insurance, but my policy was still unaffordable, so I flew to Nicaragua, where the insulin was $55 a bottle, retail pharmacies. When I did the same thing in the United States, the last time I had to buy it without insurance or with incredibly high deductibles, it was $225 per bottle. It's now over $300.
Wow. Well, Stephanie, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Ryan, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Ryan, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a type 1 diabetic. I'm 23 years old, and I've had to rely on friends to give me insulin when my doctors weren't able to refill it, or I couldn't afford to go to the hospital because they charge a copay as well. And innovation just costs a lot of money as well.
So you said you've been getting insulin from friends, and have you been having to ration it, Ryan?
I have. I've had to decrease my dose that I'm supposed to be taking so that I can save my insulin for longer.
Ryan, I mean, this has got to be really nerve-wracking for you, because Dr. Lipska was telling us, and you must know firsthand, that you're playing with your health there.
Yeah. I just got to do it. If I want to, I'd rather have a smaller dose every day and be able to take it longer than have the dose I need and run out.
Yeah. Well, Ryan, thank you for your call. Dr. Lipska, let me turn back to you here, because we're going to be hearing a lot of this from callers throughout the air, I'm sure. And just to reiterate, they feel like they have to ration their insulin, that they have no choice. But they are running a risk with their health, are they not? I mean, what other options do they have?
Well, we're putting patients in absolutely awful with awful choices, right? And this is cruel. It's cruel to patients. It's cruel to doctors, because what can we do also in terms of helping our patients when they cannot afford these essential treatments? I think it's really important, though, for patients to let their doctors know and try to brainstorm together solutions about how best to use the insulin. Sometimes, as I mentioned, particularly for patients with type 2 diabetes, we can substitute different types of insulin. We can assist patients selecting different prescriptions plans that will put them in better position to be able to afford these. There are pharmacies, 340B pharmacies, that have some subsidize some of the cost of insulin, so they tend to be a little bit cheaper. So there are ways to, like,
work within the system. These are Band-Aid solutions, though, right? Mm. The system has to change because this is absolutely unacceptable. And I agree with you that this puts patients at risk in terms of their complications of diabetes.
Right. Well, you know, we have to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll talk about what might be practicable solutions given the U.S. healthcare system. But we've got a lot of comments coming in. D. Kieft says, having lived in the U.K. and having availability to medicine, the U.S. really needs to look at big pharma and insurance companies. Her prescriptions in the U.K. were basically $9. Mike L. says, making a profit from a patented product is good business. When the product is essential for life, though, it's called price gouging. We're talking about insulin and how it's become so expensive that it's out of reach for a quarter of the 7 million Americans who rely on it to survive, and what we can do about it given America's broken prescription drug pricing system. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about insulin and how and why it's become so expensive that it's out of reach, potentially out of reach for a quarter of the many millions of Americans who need it to survive every single day. I'm joined today by Dr. Vikas Sani, by Dr. Kasia Lipska, and by Dylan Scott as well. And I just want to reiterate, we did put out a request to the three major manufacturers of insulin, Eli Lilly, Sanofi, and Novo Nordisk. They control 99% of the global insulin market. They all declined to join us, as did the lobbying group Pharma. They declined as well. We have statements from all three companies, though. We'll link to those at onpointradio.org. But I just want to read a brief part of Novo Nordisk's statement, for example. As they say, because people are looking to us to continue innovating against the serious disease, we remain committed to identifying additional solutions to address access and affordability. It will require efforts from all parties in the U.S. healthcare system to solve this challenge, and we want to be part of the solution. Sanofi says it's important to note that they've implemented new innovative programs to ensure individuals without insurance or without adequate insurance have access to their medicine. So they talk about some of their programs as well. Dylan Scott, let me just turn to you here, because I want to hear from all three of you about actual solutions that might work in the U.S. market. You've covered this extensively. Congress is considering all sorts of things: getting generics on the market faster, capping out-of-pocket costs, opening up imports from Canada. What about the big one, having the government be a more robust negotiator for drugs? Which one of these solutions actually has kind of a path forward in the United States?
Well, I do think in the near term you have to look at more small-bore solutions that do have, though, bipartisan support, which is obviously important with a Democratic House and a Republican Senate and White House. So I think in that realm you have these ideas like making it easier for generics to get to the market, although I would note that insulin is somewhat challenging in that regard because it's a biologic drug, which means it's more complex. It uses larger molecules and living cells. And so there's actually been some estimates put out that even if we were to get the generic version of that, what's known as a biosimilar, onto the market, it would only probably bring costs down 20 to 40% versus the brand name drugs, compared to, for more conventional medications, generics are usually 80% cheaper than their brand name counterparts. And so, but that's one place where I think Republicans and Democrats have shown an interest. There are other ideas out there, like, you know, just capping how much insurance companies are allowed to ask their patients to pay out of pocket for prescription drugs. And then I think the biggest idea that speaks most directly to this problem that we we've heard is Elizabeth Warren has put out a bill that would actually require the government within 1 year to start producing a generic form of insulin. Now, that is not a plan that's going to be passed into law anytime soon. But as the Democratic primary heats up, I think you can expect those candidates to talk about little more ambitious solutions to these problems and how to more fundamentally change the pharmaceutical market so that medications like insulin become more affordable.
So, Dr. Sani, is that sort of wholesale rethink of our pricing models what you think we need? Should the government get into the drug manufacturing business?
I personally don't know if the drug drug manufacturing business is something that the government should get into. But it's clear that it's currently a monopoly, certainly in insulin and many other areas. So the government has had a long role in regulating monopolies. I think they've fallen asleep at the switch here. So I think that's one dimension. The other dimension really is that given the extent to which government funding, taxpayer money, funds the R&D, you know, there are ways and laws that can be changed. The Bayh-Dole Act and many other regulatory aspects of our system can be changed. Personally, I do think a wholesale rethink is needed, absolutely needed, because we have to match the solutions to the scale of the problem. And that means, I think, that people who need essential medications should be able to get them free at the point of care. What that means is the rest of the system should be reconfigured to make that possible. And if that's going to happen, what it's going to require is a very different model with transparency on all the pricing and all the rebates or kickbacks or whatever you want to call them, and a much more fundamental recognition that insurance coverage and drug benefit coverage are so tightly linked that they have to be considered as a single piece. And a lot of the problems that we see and that we've been seeing in these young people who've died have died because of the high list price and the fragmented insurance coverage. The two can't be solved independently, I don't think.
Well, so Dr. Lipska, jump in here, because what's your thoughts about how do we achieve, for example, the price transparency that Dr. Sani was talking about, given the complexity of the system now? I mean, how would we get there?
Good question. I have to say, you know, transparency is a good start, right? We need to understand the system. We need to understand how money is passing hands, who is profiting how much, so that we can see what's fair, what's not fair, what needs to be fixed. But that's a starting point. I have to say, I'm tired of waiting. Mm. What am I supposed to do in my clinic? What is Stephanie, what is Ryan supposed to do when they can't pay for the insulin? I think we have to try some of these solutions that are on the table and see how well they work. With respect to the generic competition, I just want to say that we do actually have again, it's not a generic, it's a biologic, since insulin is a biologic, as Dylan pointed out, mm-hmm. we have a follow-on glargine product called Basaglar. It's a follow-on biologic, so-called generic. It's been on the market. It is a tiny bit less expensive than Lantus, but not by much. It's still, I just checked this morning, you know, $250 for a carton of pens of Basaglar. So very, very expensive. So I think if we're going to have more competition, it has to be a lot more. And based on some of the studies done by the FDA, you need to have five or more manufacturers to really bring prices down. So I think we have a long ways to go there.
Oh, I see. Before the power of the generics can moderate
exactly.
the price in the market. Okay.
Yeah.
Dr. Sani?
Yeah. I think that, you know, the scale of the problem is such that we really do need to start thinking about moonshots. So, for example, there's really no reason for the middlemen. The middlemen, the pharmaceutical benefit managers, supposedly exist to lower prices for everyone. Instead, what's happened is they've driven prices up and then get these rebates that only they see. So nobody else is seeing them. When pharma says that that's been a driver, they're not wrong. But at the end of the day, let's be clear, they have not been hurt one iota by this. So a moonshot for me would be for the government to step in and say, we're going to not just negotiate prices, we're actually going to create a benefit system in which we ascertain eligibility and we ensure that everybody who is a resident of the United States who needs an essential medication will have coverage to do so.
But the government hasn't even been willing to do that with Medicare recipients. I mean, just yesterday at the protest that you led, I spoke with one of the protesters, the gentleman who was 70 years old, Mr. Drilling, who said he's on Medicare. Because he has a pump, an insulin pump, he's covered. But if he had to take an injectable form of insulin, he might fall in the, you know, the Part D donut hole and have to pay for it. So yeah. We don't even have an extant system that works there for people who do have coverage through the government.
Absolutely. What's lacking is political will. The reality is, I mean, Donald Trump said something incredibly true when he said the pharmaceutical sector is getting away with murder. That's actually a true statement that he made. And the reality is the political will is what's lacking. So if you see people change their opinion, the way you see that happen is typically not through, you know, 10, 20 years of argument. Usually you see that happen when they face the voters, when they have to understand that this is a crisis that they're going to have to address. Whatever they were willing to do in the past doesn't really matter. We're talking about solutions for the future.
So I'm going to get back to college in just a second. But Dylan Scott, help us understand these pharmacy benefit managers here for another minute. Because, you know, as Dr. Sani was saying, they're supposed to bring prices down. They're supposed to help negotiate prices down. But because their form of incentive is those rebates, they're incentivized to negotiate prices up. But what's the relationship between these PBMs and insurers themselves? Don't the insurance companies actually own them?
Well, we've started to see some mergers in this space that I think have raised a lot of eyebrows. CVS Caremark has been absorbed into Assure recently, and there's been other talks about PBMs and insurers linking up. And so they present this as like, this would give us the leverage to negotiate with more directly with the pharmaceutical companies. We'd kind of eliminate that middleman paradigm that we have right now, and therefore hopefully that would help to bring prices down. I think the question is whether that would really be true or whether, you know, insurance companies would have just absorbed some of the profits that the PBMs now make independently. Another piece of this that I think is worth mentioning is that the Trump administration has, to their credit, zeroed in on this rebate problem. They have rolled out some proposals that would, in essence, require that if a PBM or a health insurer receives a discount on a pharmaceutical drug, that those savings must be passed along to the patients. As we've noted a few times now, that's right now where PBMs grab their share of the money. That's where they're able to make their profits, is by taking a piece of that rebate and keeping it for themselves. And that's why patients don't see the full savings on their end. And that's why you always hear the pharmaceutical companies talk about how the discounts and the rebates are the real problem.
Right. Well, let's go back to our callers. Let's go to Chase, who's calling from Savannah, Georgia. Chase, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am now 20 years old. I've had diabetes practically my whole life. I got diagnosed at 11 months along with my identical twin brother. And until recently, I actually had no idea about the need for insulin for people who can't afford it. I'm currently under my parents' insurance, so I only pay about $25 every time I go to get a carton of insulin. And one of my biggest concerns is what happens when I'm no longer covered under my parents' insurance. I'm really hoping by that time that this price is fixed, because I don't think I'll be able to afford insulin if I can no longer be supplied by my parents. Mm. And it's just extremely concerning for me because, you know, I need it to live. I take it multiple times a day, and it's extremely stressful to think that other people are dying because they can't get something that they need to live.
Yeah. Well, Chase, thank you so much for your call. Dr. Lipska, what would you advise Chase to do? I mean, he's looking at a future where he may have a gap in his insurance coverage.
Right. Chase, I can only empathize how, you know, how stressful that must be. I think that means that all of us have about 5 to 6 years to solve this problem so that Chase doesn't face this when he ages out of his parents' insurance. But a lot of patients, you know, a lot of people with type 1 diabetes are saying, you know, we really worry about our jobs. We have to find jobs that specifically give us a good insurance plans. And it's extremely stressful to live in a world where you have to think that way in order to survive, right? Because insulin is so essential.
Well, let's take one more call. Let's go to Sherman, who's calling from Miami, Florida. Sherman, you're on the air.
Hi. Your panelists alluded to innovation, and callers talked about the free market as a solution, and I think that is fundamentally a mistake. And as your panelists suggested, so much of the innovation that goes on in the country is actually created by the government. And what we have are companies that have been promoting this notion that they need to make these profits, and that's just simply not true. So really part of the solution, because they use these same techniques, it's in affordable housing, in so many aspects of our society, that the way to really change it is we have to change it at the polls. We have to elect officials who are willing to take on the system and saying that government has an important role in this, and we are going to make sure that people have the things they need, whether it's drugs or whether it's affordable housing, education, transportation. That's what has to take place. And the fake news is saying that government needs to stay out of these things.
Well, Sherman, thank you so much for your call. Dylan Scott, let me turn back to you briefly, and for all of us, all my guests here today, we just got a couple minutes left to go. But Dylan, there's something I want to ask you. Not that long ago, I had a conversation with, you know, another physician who's looked at the prescription drug crisis, cost crisis here in the United States. And she essentially said that, you know, the truth is that the U.S. taxpayer, U.S. patients and U.S. Insurance holders are subsidizing, given our current system, they're basically subsidizing the lower cost that other people in other countries see because their governments will negotiate prices down. So what if we flipped it all on its head? I mean, one of the ideas that Congress is kicking around is using those foreign drug prices as essential benchmarks or even price controls to in terms of how much things should cost here. Is that realistic at all? Does that have a future in America?
Well, it is it's an idea that's gotten some interest from both sides of the aisle. The Trump administration has floated a pilot project that would effectively use foreign prices as price controls here. Bernie Sanders and Representative Ro Khanna in the House have proposed a bill that would do much the same thing. I think there are a lot of questions about how that kind of policy would actually work. As it's been described to me, the ideal is that prices in foreign countries go up a little bit, prices in the United States come down. But I think the concern is that if foreign countries don't react as we'd expect, and if they just keep their prices low and then American prices come all the way down to meet them, that maybe that's when you start to get to a place where we're cutting into the revenue for pharmaceutical companies so much that we do start to worry about what the effects on innovation might be. The difficult thing about this entire issue is that I think everybody seems to agree that innovation has kind of become a red herring that the pharmaceutical companies use to discourage any kind of price controls. But there is some kind of point, like we want a market that incentivizes innovation. And you do have to worry as you get more and more aggressive about when you start to cross a line and really do start to impede innovation.
Well, Dr. Sandy, we just got 30 seconds left to go. So I'm going to give you the last thought of the day. How do we fix this?
Well, I want to acknowledge the families of the people who've died. They've shown the kind of leadership that we all have to step up and meet. That's a challenge for all of us. I don't see it as strictly a political question. It's really a moral question. Are we going to have a community, and are we going to support each other? And if that's true, then a lot of other things will have to follow.
Well, Dr. Vikas Sani is co-chair of the Right Care Alliance, a grassroots patient advocacy coalition. He's also president of the Lown Institute, a nonpartisan healthcare think tank that's challenging the high cost of healthcare in America. Dr. Sani, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Dr. Kasia Lipska, endocrinologist and diabetes researcher at the Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Lipska, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Dylan Scott, healthcare reporter for Vox. It was great to have you. We've got links to Dylan's reporting at onpointradio.org. Thanks so much, Dylan.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.